Okay. So, well, first of all, I want to thank you very much for the invitation to come here. It's really great. Great to be here. And so this is the Canadian stick, I suppose. So I would like to explain how, so this talk is about, yeah, it's not, I'm not really a quantum gravity person, as you probably know. So my background is more in the context of non-commutative field theory. But I would like to explain how gravity, or at least some form of gravity, emerges effectively out of certain very simple matrix models of non-commutative gauge theory. And okay, that's based on some recent work of mine, which you can find on the web. But I will also mention some more recent results, which will be published very soon. Okay, so I can be very short on the introduction. Probably almost everybody would agree that the classical concepts of space and time are probably not the appropriate ones once we start to approach the Planck scale, just because quantum mechanics enters the game and will introduce some kind of uncertainties at least. So space should be in some sense quantized, and perhaps one approach is that space should be in some sense non-commutative. And well, this led to the development of what is known as non-commutative quantum field theory. And the idea is simply that you want to, construct a generalization of quantum field theory, but not based, which doesn't live on classical space, but which lives on some kind of a non-commutative space. Now, okay, that's a subject which has been has been developed pretty far in the recent years. And okay, much progress has been done, but there is also several important open problems. So it's not at a completely satisfactory state at the moment. And one point is, of course, that, well, if we talk about such things, one should really ask the question, so what about gravity in this context? Because after all, that was the motivation of even starting with to consider non-commutative spaces. And I would say that if this idea of non-commutative spaces is going to be successful in this context, then the implementation of gravity should be very simple and natural in this context. And it should not be difficult. It should be something which is an intrinsic part of the story. And so I think this is actually the case, and I would like to explain how I think this should work. Now, so the main message of this talk is the following. There is a very simple class of models which actually describe dynamical non-commutative spaces, so not just some fixed ones. And these models are known as matrix models. Now, matrix models, of course, I will be more specific, they are known to describe non-commutative gauge theory. This is one of the standard formulations of non-commutative gauge theory. But in fact, so the main point of this talk is that, in fact, matrix models also contain gravity. And they contain gravity in a certain surprising and completely non-commutative fashion. So it's not a straightforward generalization of how you write down general relativity. It's something different. And in fact, the kind of gravity that emerges here is not precisely general relativity. It's something different. But also surprisingly, it seems to agree, at least to some extent, reasonably well with general relativity in some, let's say, low energy limiting regimes. And in particular, so the aspects which I will discuss a bit are gravitational waves, Newtonian limit of the gravity, and we'll also see that at least in a linearized case, the vacuum equations of motion come out as in a standard way, so they're Ricci flat, which is not evident a priori here. Now, and the other point I would like to make here is that the type of gravity that you find in this context is, I would say, is certainly easier to quantize than general relativity. Now, that's of course a completely premature statement, but nevertheless, I will explain to some extent why I think that's true. So even though that's not standard general relativity, it's some interesting theory of gravity, which probably certainly has some advantages, and one has to see where it leads to. Okay, so let me first give you the main result, and then I will sort of go more slowly. So just, this is technically speaking the main result, or one of the main results is the following. So consider this matrix model. Now, the dynamical objects are matrices XA. A goes from 0 to 3, so I want to consider four-dimensional space, so I consider four matrices. I could do 10 matrices and have 10-dimensional space. Now, and then you take the trace of the commutator of two such matrices square. And, well, to contract the indices of the commutators, you need, there is an eta symbol, and these are just constant standard eta symbols. So they are not, those are not dynamical. It's just a standard iterator. So I could, so this is the Minkowski case, of course. One could do the Euclidean case by writing delta here. But, all right. So that's the model. And that's the simplest type of matrix model that one can think of. And this is a standard model which arises in various contexts. And OK, I will sort of explain its content. And again, so the dynamical objects are matrices. And you should think of them as being very large n times n matrices. And essentially, n should perhaps go to infinity or should be very large. But I will not go into these details here. OK, now, all right, so that's the definition of the model, if you like. Not directly, no, no, no. So the size of these matrices have nothing to do with the rank of a gauge group, no. Now, yeah, okay, this notation is a bit provocative. This is supposed to be Young-Mills. I will show that it actually, the name is not appropriate. But this is a, this is what is known, everybody would call it non-commutative Young-Mills.
It is Young-Mills on the subsector of fields that are constant space.
Well, yeah, okay. You can obtain that this is, yeah, zero dimensional reduction of standard Young-Mills and so on. There is all kinds of ways of obtaining it. Let me just write it down and, okay. Nothing. XR, so XR huge matrices, and the entries, each entry of the matrix X is a dynamical object. And I will write down equations of motion and so on. So this is the dynamical content. The matrices are completely arbitrary. They're Hermitian, sorry. Okay, above. No. There is no time, there's no space, nothing. That's the point. It's just a matrix. It's the simplest thing you can possibly write down. It's yeah, this is an action. No. These are the parameters are the entries of the matrices. So this is an action and it's a functional which depends on the entries of these matrices. Don't think too complicated. First semester linear algebra. Nothing more. I will, of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah. Sure. I will talk about that. Yeah.
I mean, to me, it looks like the Young-Mills action, you could write a commutator of PDU times commutator of PDU.
I'll come to that. But don't worry about it. Don't worry about it.
This is really just what he says.
Yeah, it's the simplest thing you can think of. I mean, first, as I say, first semester. There's no space and no time again. Now, okay. Now the statement. Right. So now the point is that there will be solutions and there will be backgrounds to this matrix model, and these backgrounds will define you some approximate notions of space and time. I will define that. Now there is many of these solutions backgrounds which I'll describe, and generically the effective action of small fluctuations around such a background looks as follows. Now that's already much more interesting. Now it turns out that effectively around such a geometrical background, I claim that this is SUN Young-Mills theory coupled to an effective metric and some additional stuff. Now let's see. So what are the entries here? So F is now really a SUN field strength which lives on the geometrical background, which is a non-commutative space, which I'll write down in a second. So this is really what you. This is an X, a space-dependent field strength of a four-dimensional Young-Mills theory, which happens to be SUN here. And so this is the ordinary Young-Mills action. So you have F square, and the indices of F are contracted with an effective metric capital G. And capital G is a dynamical, it's not a flat metric, which has the following form. It's built out of an effective Poisson tensor. And two of these indices of the Poisson tensor are contracted with the eta, which is part of this original matrix model. And I'll show you how this data comes about. Now, of course, I write down what is F really. So the claim is that the low energy effective action of this matrix model is essentially SUN Young-Mills coupled to a non-trivial metric. There is an additional scalar part of the action which involves some funny scalar fields. And surprisingly enough, there is even an F which F term, which is not topological because there is a function eta of pi also in front of it. So that's sort of technically one of the main results here. And what it means is that these matrix models is actually, well, it's not only SUN Young-Mills, which is the first surprise. People would have thought it's UN Young-Mills, but it's SUN Young-Mills. And it actually also contains a dynamical gravity. So the space, which I've assumed here, is actually not a fixed one. It's a dynamical one. And it has an action. And physically, it behaves as if it is governed by some gravity theory. And that gravity theory is close to general relativity. So that's one of the main technical results. And now let me, okay, so this is what I want to do now. Okay, so first I will want to explain why is a matrix model something like a non-commutative gauge theory. Then I'll explain how you derive the effective metric and an effective geometry out of this matrix model. And I'll explain how to obtain the low energy effective action, which I just wrote down for you. And okay, then we'll discuss some checks. One of them is gravitational waves and linearized, the case of linearized metric. And the other limit is Newtonian limit. So these are sort of basic consistency checks of the kind of gravity that you get out of this model. And then I'll say a little bit about quantization, the connection with UVIR mixing, which is very important. And okay, that's about it. I hope I have enough time. Okay, so now let's go slowly. So this is, again, this is the matrix model. And so this, you should think of some kind of a toy candidate for a fundamental theory. I mean, I don't want to be too pretentious here, but you can couple matter here, and you can extend this model to some extent. But let's just focus on this sector. Now, again, the dynamical objects are the matrices or the entries of these matrices, and there is four of these matrices. Now, let's consider the equations of motion. Equations of motion are very easy to derive. You get the cubic equation involving these matrices. This is sometimes known as Young-Mills algebra. It's straightforward to derive this here. And, well, these equations of motion have lots of different solutions. Now, let's discuss some of the solutions. The simplest type of solution is if the matrices commute pairwise. Now, obviously, this is a solution of this equation, but I will actually ignore these solutions here. They exist, but first of all, their phase space is probably not very large. They're not essential, probably, at the quantum level. And they would describe some kind of classical objects. So they could describe points, or they could even describe extended objects whose coordinates is given by the eigenvalues of these matrices. Okay, they have some interest, but let me ignore these here. Now, let me focus on different solutions. And the most important solution is if the commutator of two of these axes is the unit matrix, and of course times an antisymmetric, constant antisymmetric tensor theta AB. So theta AB is now a numerical antisymmetric tensor, and this is a unit matrix. And of course, if you plug it in here, you'll find that this is indeed a solution of the equation of motion. Okay, and this is, by the way, this is known as a quantum plane or Moyal-Weil quantum space. And what it is, of course, this is just a quantum mechanical phase space. So this is a non-commutative version of a flat space. And it happens to be a four-dimensional space because I work with four matrices here. And this is one of the standard starting points when you consider non-commutative field theory. This is as good as R4, just it has some uncertainty built in. Okay, now, but the point is that this equation of motion has many more solutions. It doesn't just have the flat solution, it has actually curved versions of it also. And typically, so the generic solution that I will consider has the form, well, the commutator of those two x's is not the unit matrix anymore, but it's some non-trivial matrix, and that non-trivial matrix in a suitable semi-classical limit, let me assume that it corresponds to a Poisson tensor. And this is really the generic case. So it means a generic semi-classical solution of this equation is a quantization of a Poisson manifold. One can make this more precise, and the converse is actually also true. If you have a Poisson manifold, there is always some kind of a quantization like that. Yeah.
What do you mean in this lab that the theta is a function of that?
Yeah, yeah, okay. So I'm a bit sloppy. So these capital X's turn out to be a good approximation to classical coordinate functions XA. And now I replace these quantum objects by the semi-classical limit, which is the little x. So when I write little x, this is the semi-classical coordinate function whose quantization is capital X. And so little x is the leading, so capital X is leading x plus small corrections, if you like. This is a little bit hand-waving here, but when I say semi-classical, I mean that I keep this classical function here and I drop higher order terms in theta, because I assume theta is small. Yes.
Sorry if you answered before, but are these
You should think of them as being infinite dimensional or very large with n going to infinity, yes.
Well, I mean, if they're finite.
No, sure. For this equation, of course, they have to be infinite dimensional, sure, yeah. So think of them as being infinite dimensional, otherwise there is no solution. But there is also, actually, there is compactifications of this thing which have similar properties and then there can be finite dimensional. So this point is not crucial here. But of course, you're right that here, whenever. Yeah, then this would be approximate. And on the right-hand side, you would have something which is not exactly one, but has some kind of a compactification built in. One can make this more precise, but that's not the point here, so I don't want to.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, there's I mean, maybe I can give you examples later on. So, but that's really not the point here. Okay. So, so the conclusion is now that this model actually, because here I say that the semi-classic limit of a commutator is essentially a Poisson structure. Now, if you look at the action, that it means that this action is actually, it's really an action for dynamical non-commutative spaces or dynamical quantized spaces. Because essentially this here is a Poisson tensor, and this is an action for the Poisson structure on a space. So, and you see it also here, the solutions of this action are actually geometrical spaces, or at least some of these solutions are geometrical spaces. And I just want to get the message across that this is a theory of dynamical non-commutative spaces. Yes?
Maybe you're going to explain that.
Yeah, yeah, I will. Yes, yes. I just want to get this idea. Okay. Now let's consider the simplest solution, which is known as the Moyal-Weil quantum plane. Again, that's just quantum mechanical phase space, or maybe the product of quantum mechanical phase spaces. And now let's add some fluctuations around such a solution. So let's pick a solution, and let's just start with the simplest one. Now, this kind of an object is known as covariant coordinate in the context of non-commutative gauge theory. That's a fundamental object there. And, well, why is that? Now, an important observation is if you now take the commutator of this generator of the quantum plane with any function of capital Y, again, you know from quantum mechanics that this is something like a partial derivative operator, at least in the leading semi-classical limit. So you should think of such a commutator being, it's a partial derivative of this function f. Now I'm replacing quantum mechanical observables with classical functions to leading order. But in fact, it's not a partial derivative. You have to raise the index with the Poisson structure living here on the right side. That's a trivial computation, which you know from quantum mechanics, essentially, in a different form. Now, if you use this, you notice now you can compute the commutator of two such matrices. It's the ingredient of the original matrix model. And you see very easily that it has the structure of a non-abelian field strength. It's just straightforward plugging it in. It's well known. So essentially, this object, now I assume that this is a function of y in some semi-classical limit again. Then you see that this object is actually something like a non-abelian field strength of a non-abelian gauge theory, with indices raised by the theta. And this is basically the reason why people say that the matrix model, which I just wrote down, describe, for example, U1 Young-Mills theory on the quantum plane, because if you now plug in this thing in the original action, I get up to a constant, which I drop. I get the contraction of two of these field strength with an effective metric, but this effective metric is actually not the original eta. It's constructed using the original eta, but it involves the Poisson tensor, which define the space, yes.
Do you have an extra assumption in saying, say, the A1 fluctuation is a function of the X2 matrix?
No, I consider the most general fluctuation, but I assume that it makes sense to consider it as a semi-classical, as a function on Y. Okay. So
maybe, I mean, I've seen this very badly.
Okay, so typically, think of this A being some power series of Y, which has something like a cutoff behavior. So, for example, think of this being some Gaussian wave bracket or something like that, written in terms of Y. And such things have, then you can consider something like a quantization map. So, if you have, for example, consider Weyl quantization, then you can consider Gaussian functions on classical phase space. They're really represented by something like Gaussian function in terms of the quantum generators plus higher order corrections in H bar. Now, H bar here is data, and I ignore higher order corrections in data. So for suitable classes of functions here, which you can make more precise, I mean, there's all kinds of more precise versions of it, this can be interpreted as a well-behaved, perhaps, function which perhaps falls off at infinity living on that space. And this is a rather generic situation. I mean, okay.
A bit more formal. Here, what you're saying is that if you look at the algebra, unwrapping algebra generated by the Y bar, then this should be somehow the whole algebra of matrices.
Yes, that's right. I mean, yeah. So, yeah, okay. So very loosely speaking, I mean, there is a map, there's a quantization map between functions on R4 to more or less being, okay, well-behaved bounded operators on the Hilbert space. It's not just bounded operators. You maybe you want to give some more mathematical conditions, but this is a Weyl quantization map. And basically, the way to construct it is you map plane waves to plane waves. That's one standard construction. And here, the x hat, sorry, in that notation, it would be y. So these are this would be the capital Y, and this would be the little y here in my notation. Sometimes I use x and y. So there is a reasonably well-defined way how to associate classical functions on a space with suitable properties to more or less the most general matrices with suitable properties.
But there are lots of things in another range you cannot span.
Yeah.
Ubikky, for example, Ubikky, the momentum conjugate to y.
No. Maybe that is the confusion. So, okay, usually in quantum mechanics you have xp. Here I call this x1 and x2. Sorry, there is no p. What one calls p in quantum mechanics is one of the x's here. Maybe that was the confusion, sorry.
So the Hilbert space is the Hilbert space spanned by x1 and x2.
Yes, okay. So when I say R2 theta, the two-dimensional quantum plane here is the same as what one calls in. So here in my notation, it has generators y1, y2, but that's really the same in quantum mechanics as x and p. And when I have R four-dimensional one, it's just you double this. So the p's are already, of course, included. Sorry, maybe I should have pointed out that. So really, the most general observable with suitable conditions is a function and vice versa. Okay. And if you just put all this together, you see that it's reasonable. Well, in the semi-classical limit, this action really looks like a U1 Young-Mills theory on the quantum plane. And there's nothing wrong with that. Now, the same story goes for the non-abelian case. So one can obtain UN gauge theory on the quantum plane, where the little n here has nothing to do with the size of the matrices. Now, one constructs it as follows. Now, you just consider different vacuums or different solution of the same matrix model. Namely, consider instead of the generators of Meyer-Weil, if you take the little n copies of the generators of Meyer-Weil, you can write it like this. This is also a solution of the original equations of motion. Now, you just consider fluctuations of the same model around this different vacuum, and you will see very easily that you find un Young-Mills on the quantum plane. So there is different vacuum solutions corresponding to the different ranks of the gauge group. Now, okay, also there's nothing wrong with this interpretation. There are just a couple of things which are strange here. So the first thing which is strange is that it turns out that in the non-commutative case, so in this model which I'm considering, the U1 sector cannot be disentangled from the SUN degrees of freedom. There's just no way to separate these degrees of freedom. And nobody knows how to define SUN gauge theory in the non-commutative case, which is a bit strange. Now, okay. Now, the other thing which is strange is that somehow we have seen that the space itself is obtained as a solution of the matrix model. So somehow one would think that if you consider now fluctuations of these coordinates, they should really correspond to gravity rather than non-abelian gauge fields, because gravity has to do with fluctuations of geometry. And in fact, that's true. Now, the other thing is that one knows in the context of string theory that there are very similar matrix models. For example, in particular, the IKKT model, and that's actually one of the candidates for a non-perturbative definition of string theory. So they are supposed to contain gravity. And to some extent, this has even been verified. So there are some graviton scattering computations and so on with the same type of matrix models. So it really seems that these matrix models should contain gravity somehow. Now, and in fact, this idea has really been spelled out. So perhaps the first time, so the idea is then that, I claim it's the U1 sector of non-commutative gauge theory, which is actually should be interpreted as gravity. Now, this idea is not completely new. And in fact, the first time an observation like this has been made was several years ago by Reveles. And more recently, Young has sort of made this proposal more explicit. And so what I'm going to say is give a precise version of how this gravity is obtained from the U1 sector of non-commutative gauge theory in this type of matrix models. Okay, so now how do you get geometry from the same U1 matrix model? Okay, let's go back to the matrix, which so far I split it into the background generator, Meyer-Weil plane, plus fluctuations. Now, I don't want to split this anymore. Let's keep the original object. And as I said in the beginning, the most general X, as long as it's reasonable, semi-classical in some sense, the commutator of those is essentially a Poisson tensor in the semi-classical limit, and vice versa. One can show that any classical Poisson manifold can be quantized in such a way, at least under reasonable conditions. Now, if you now consider the commutator of this general X with some function of this general X, let me suppose it's a scalar field, you see again by the same argument that in the leading term in a semi-classical expansion is a partial derivative of the scalar field, but now you have to go to write the general Poisson tensor theta of X in front of it. These are very simple observations. There's nothing new about it. And now to understand the meaning of this matrix model, let me introduce some extra matter. Let me introduce an extra scalar field and couple it to the model, because then one understands better what's going on. And basically, the only way you can write down a reasonable action for an extra scalar field coupled to this covariant coordinates is this type of model. So you take the commutator of the scalar field with X, you take it twice, and you contract the indices of the original eta. This will give you a kinetic term. That's the only thing you can do, really. By the way, I forgot to say that the whole thing is a gauge theory, because there is gauge invariance XA going to U inverse XAU, and this is a fundamental symmetry of the action. This is why it's a matrix model. And this symmetry is preserved in this additional term also.
But now, if you don't make this splitting, you can't really identify what you call the small x.
Still the small x is now the semi-classical limit of the whole thing. If you quantize a Poisson manifold, the leading term of its quantization is always the coordinate function on that Poisson manifold. The first term in the commutator is its Poisson bracket, etc. So these are solid things. I mean, there's no, these are. I really don't want to think about star products here. This is the commutator of matrices, and the leading term is given in the semi-classical limit by such a thing. So there's no star product, it's just a matrix commutator.
You're
right. So if you want to talk about small x, it's true. One can still. So one defines a generalization of this map, and this is what is called a quantization. So quantization means now you have here a more general space, and you associate to it an algebra of observables. And in this way, you can still associate the little x on that side to the capital X on the right side. This can be done, this can also be done using star products, but I don't really want to go into that here, because that's not important. And I mean, they're reasonably well. These are more or less standard things for quantization. I mean, up to subtleties, but.
This is somehow a crucial point, a crucial point.
Okay, maybe I should.
For example, if this was purely gravity, then you would expect some general covariance associated with changes.
No, the point is that there is no general covariance is broken here. That's nevertheless, so it is a gravity. Which is gauge fixed. So the general diffeo invariance is gauge fixed. There is no general diffeo invariance. Nevertheless, it's gravity in a reasonable sense, which I'm going to explain. Yeah, you will see. It comes out to be gauge fixed gravity. I mean, the original matrix model has no diffeo invariance. The original matrix model has this type of gauge invariance, and it has the global Poincaré invariance, and that's it. There's actually a small part of the diffeo invariance which survives, which are the symplectic morphisms. I'll talk about this perhaps. But there is no full general covariance, not on the fundamental level, on the semi.
No,
yeah, okay, I'll come back to some point approximately, yes. Okay.
Yes, is your capital G a density weight?
The density, I'll come to the density business. Yeah.
Does this symmetry correspond to some conservation law or at least some Bianchi type, I think?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, so from the point of view of gauge theory, this corresponds to ordinary gauge theory, and you have all the standard business that you know from ordinary non-abelian gauge theory, let's say. Or in this chronogeometric point of view, it corresponds to symplectic morphisms, which are a subgroup of diffeomorphisms. But this is a gauge group. Sorry?
Is this not bigger than these symplectomorphisms, or is it the same?
No, it's the same as a symplectomorphism. It's precisely, these are precisely diffeomorphisms, which you get, which is a small subgroup of diffeomorphisms.
Small subgroup? Yeah. But you have an infinite.
It's an infinite dimension. Yeah, it's an infinite dimensional group.
You say that an infinite dimension is an identifier.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Symplectomorphisms. And the symplectomorphism group is, of course, an infinite dimensional group.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I mean, this is, in fact, this is also more or less well known. This is not new. I mean, in this context, okay, they're really, sorry.
Are you claiming that the symplectomorphisms form a U and U infinity
group? Okay, I mean, here really the process of the limiting process is really subtle. So here one really has to be careful, and I don't want to make such precise claims. But you can see that on the level of generators for infinitesimal symplectomorphism, you can really see that in a superficial way it works. Now, here there are really subtle points, and the limit of U infinity is something very subtle. And I don't want to go into that here. But morally, it corresponds to symplectomorphisms. Okay. Now, if we come back to this observation, so we had a scalar field which was coupled to the matrix model using this object. Now, if I use the semi-classical, so I'm now working out the semi-classical version of this term, and just plug in this formula here, and you see immediately that you get the kinetic term for the scalar field, so you get two partial derivatives, and they are contracted with an effective matrix GAB, which is not a constant matrix, and it has precisely this form. And you see it immediately because it just comes from the data sticking out of this formula here. And so this is the dynamical metric which eventually corresponds to gravity. And it is built out of a Poisson, a general Poisson structure, which you take twice, and two of the indices of the Poisson structure are contracted by a constant flat background eta symbol. So that's the effective metric. So of course, I will say more about this metric later. Of course, you don't get the most general metric in this way, but this is a reasonably large class of metrics, which somehow, and nobody could really tell me about it, but one of the main points here is that this is a large enough class of metrics to accommodate a reasonable theory of gravity. That would be the message. It's a funny formula, but so you have a Poisson manifold, which and in addition a flat Minkowski metric, and out of this you can make a dynamical metric, and this is not a flat metric, it has some interesting properties. And the point is that all the kinetic terms in this theory will always couple to this effective metric. This is why some of the geodesics of this metric and really govern the motion of particles, and this is why this is a kind of a gravity theory. Yeah, it's closely related to the open string metric. Now, if this was if this tensor was constant, then it would be precisely the open string metric. Now, if this tensor is not constant, I mean, one has to be careful. First of all, the open string metric in this context, I would say, is debatable. And to some extent, it is the open string metric. But I think, for the case of non-constant data, this business with open string metric on deep brains is not so clear, I would say. So, sorry. Yeah. Okay. Then. Okay. You can call it open string metric. It's fine. Yeah. Okay. So. So the message is that, well, at least for scalar fields, the kinetic term couples to an effective metric given by that formula, which depends on the dynamical Poisson tensor. And you see, of course, from this formula that also in some sense this theta plays the role of a field bind. But of course, it's a very special field bind, and it's a gauge-fixed field bind. You cannot start to local Lorentz transformation because you would immediately violate the structure. So, but there is a certain preferred field bind, which is determined by the dynamical Poisson structure, actually, and it defines the metric in the standard way, yes?
Yeah, so usually, yeah, I mean, if you make some Lorentz gauge fixing, you can always go to a symmetric field bind.
Yeah, this is anti-symmetric. This is different. Yeah, it's very different. So I have not seen this before. If somebody can tell me.
You say it's gauge fixing. You know, it's not like any field bind can be gauge fixed.
You cannot bring any field bind to that form. You cannot. No. This is a special class of field binds. It's a funny thing, but it's an interesting class of metrics. That's the point. Yes?
Even if this is a restricted class of metrics, is the problem right? If I quantize this and said that G is some function of your space of time, then in the counter terms,
Yeah, yeah, I'll come to that. I'll come to that. Sure, that's yeah, sure.
So in some sense, you have gravity.
Of course, yeah, yeah, that's a, yeah, sure, sure, that's the point. Yes.
But the question is, you know, do you have enough degrees of freedom?
That's the whole point. Yeah, that's the subject of the talk. Exactly, that's the point. Yes. So now let me very briefly. I'll skip most of this. Let me very briefly sketch a generalization to the S to the non-abelian case. That's a bit technical, but the same thing works. The point is that. Okay, originally I mentioned that non-abelian UN gauge theory is you start with the vacuum being y tensor 1n and you add the most general fluctuation. Now, this, my statement is you should collect all the U1 degrees of freedom. Don't separate the U1 degrees of freedom, but keep them as one object and keep the SUN degrees of freedom separate. These are going to be SUN gauge fields. This is going to determine the geometry in the same way that we just discussed. And so the result is that, okay, in this non-abelian situation, the U1 component YA defines your dynamical geometry and gravity, while the SUN components, they will be SUN gauge fields living on this geometry. And this is really, this comes out in a correct way. Now, that's somewhat technical. It's not so easy to do. Let me just sketch a few things. I'll skip over it. If you do the computation superficially, it seems that it's right. You see it very easily that it seems to come out right. Namely, you just compute the commutators, and you find immediately, of course, the non-abelian field strength. If you plug this in the action, you find superficially this type of term, which is the field strength coupled to this effective metric. And there are some additional funny thing. The trouble is that this computation is really somewhat illegal. I mean, because I neglect the terms which arise because I now have to commute non-constant Poisson tensors with other functions, and you pick up commutators, and it turns out that these commutators are actually of the same order as the terms I want to keep. So this kind of a naive computation doesn't work. It just gives you the hope that it might work. Now there is a good way to do the same computation, and the good way involves what is known as a cyber-written map. I will not spend any time on that because it's just technical. Let me just tell you what it is. Cyber-written map tells you how to express non-abelian gauge fields in terms of classical gauge fields. So it is a way how to obtain the same classical limit of a non-commutative gauge theory. And you just have to carry it through here carefully. The problem is that it is a cyber-written map for a non-constant data, so it makes it technically difficult, but it's not important. So if you do a lot of computation, which means you just have to work out the semi-classical limit of this action, you find the following result. Ah, yeah. One more point is that you have to be a bit careful with the traces, because naively a trace is something like an integral. But if you're on a general Poisson manifold, of course, you pick up a volume factor. And the volume is, of course, the symplectic volume defined by the Poisson structure. It's not the metric volume. But you can relate the symplectic volume in terms of the effective metrics which I have here, and you'll find the following. You don't get the square root of the determinant of the metric. You get rather the following funny combination. So the determinant of the flat background metric enters also. And that's, by the way, that's the only place where the flat background metric enters the game. The flat background metric doesn't couple to any of the fields. It doesn't enter the kinetic terms, only through this density factor. So it's very much hidden. OK, so this is something like Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization for non-constant Poisson tensors. Anyway, so you do all that. And then you find, after a lot of work, that indeed the leading term in a semi-classical expansion of the matrix model around such a general background is given by this action. So it is a SUN Young-Mills coupled to the dynamical metric which I just discussed. That metric is determined by the U1 sector. And there are some additional scalar things which are a bit funny. Now, eta of y is essentially contraction of the dynamical metric with the statical background metric. Now, okay, so it's SUN coupled to this dynamical metric. There is a surprising additional term. That's really something new, which I also didn't expect, which has a structure f watch f, which is topological for constant data, but in general it's not. And that could be very interesting because of perhaps it has to do with CP violation, things like that. But anyway, let me not discuss this here. And one surprising thing is that the U1 sector of the action, which is this one, which involves the rho is the density that I had before eta, is this funny thing. This actually implies the vacuum equations. And it turns out it implies that the vacuum is Ricci flat with respect to the dynamical metric that I just had. So that's very surprising, because this is something like the U1 sector of the gauge theory. It just I'll say more about this in a second.
How did an orientation get into this
story? Orientation. I would say the whole thing is oriented. An orientation. I mean, if I assume that I have four, I have a parallelizable space. I mean, the coordinates YA, those are supposed to be global coordinates for the sake, for the moment.
Orientable, but where does the orientation, does the ordering of the coordinates play a role?
I can't actually give you a good, I don't really understand where this term comes from. It just comes out. There's nothing, I mean.
If you have a Poisson structure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. But nevertheless, it's, yeah, that's right. You have a volume form. That's, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the inverse Poisson structure.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. But nevertheless, this term is surprising.
Another question is, what if you had, I mean, there is a U1 connection. There's a gauge U1.
Yeah.
That easy to get.
You mean the photon?
Yeah.
Now maybe I'll comment on it later. Okay. So this U1 is certainly not the U1 of the photon, that's for sure. And that's good. And I will say more about this later. So, one comment here was that the U1 sector actually implies Ricci flatness with respect to that metric. And so the U1 sector actually is really, the U1 sector is completely absorbed in the dynamical metric. That's the point. And in that sense, it's some kind of a dynamical gravity, which moreover, even at tree level here, implies Ricci flatness. That is something which is perhaps not expected. Now, in the remaining few minutes, I'll briefly consider the case of linearized gravity, gravitational wave, Newtonian limit, and I mentioned the quantization, which covers the induced Einstein-Hilbert action and the relation to UVIR mixing. Yes.
So
I go back.
It,
yeah. I'll say a little bit more about it, not in detail, but for vacuum, this is a vacuum.
But in general, you want something.
No, this statement is only true for vacuum.
You mean zero?
Yeah, yeah. If it doesn't couple to any matter, so if there is no matter.
Your action is essentially.
And also, it doesn't couple. So yeah, that's right. Assume that the non-abelian gate field is zero. That's right. Yes.
Your action.
Only
G
then.
G is essentially delta G times trace G. So how do you get there?
Yeah, it's surprising. It comes out. And that was already observed by Rivellas a long time ago to the linearized level. That's a funny thing, it comes out. I can show it. It's a half page computation. It's not trivial, but.
At least at some level. I mean, it's an ultra local action.
What do you mean, ultra local?
Right, delta G, trace of G.
No. Sorry. In the classical case, this is not true what I said. What I said is true only because this is non commutative the action. So when I derive this equation of motion, I go back to the original matrix model, and then it's true. If I start here, it's not true. Sorry. Yes. So. This statement is okay, but perhaps a little bit surprising. So the non-commutative version of this thing implies Ricci flatness. This is a completely non-commutative statement. It does not hold in the commutative version of this thing. So I cannot, there is no commutative version of this fact. This is one of the reasons it's a completely non-commutative mechanism. And it is not a difficult computation to show. And this part is actually not mine, so. Okay, so that's a fact of life. Now, okay, so I said I will try to mention these things. So let's first briefly discuss the case of linearized metric. So first of all, the Moyal space is flat in the sense that the effective metric that you get on the Moyal space is really just a flat Minkowski metric. It's not the same as the original one, but it is also a flat Minkowski signature type of metric. So that's good, of course. Now, if you now, again, if you consider the case of small fluctuations around the Moyal Weyl plane, then, okay, you compute the general Poisson tensor, the first correction to the general Poisson tensor over the constant one. It's, of course, essentially just the field strength. I use the U1 gauge theory point of view. So from the U1 gauge theory point of view, the correction to the Poisson tensor involves the field strength of the U1 gauge theory. And that means that now if you compute the metric in this linearized case, the effective metric is essentially the flat Moyal plus, okay, linearized correction. And the linearized correction is that expression in terms of the original U1 gauge fields. And so this is the linearized metric fluctuation. And this was actually given by Rivellas several years ago in a slightly different context. And so the point is that you can actually express the physical degrees of freedom, it turns out, of a graviton, which is a spin two object, sort of, but the physical degrees of freedom can be expressed here in terms of the spin of, in terms of a spin one gauge field, because you have a theta in the background. So by using the field strength and the theta, you actually obtain an object which has the suitable properties for a graviton. And remember, by the way, that I mean the physical degrees of freedom of gravitons are two, and it's the same as the physical degrees of freedom of a U1 gauge field. But again, this construction only works in the non-commutative case, of course. And it is only, so you don't get all the degrees of freedom here for gravitons, but you do get the physical ones. That's what I mean when I say it's gauge fixed. And it's almost gauge fixed. Okay. Now, okay, coming back to the gravitational equations of motion. So if the matrix equations of motion can be written in this form, this is actually a double commutator. And now in the semi-classical limit, this is the same as a non-commutative Maxwell equations of motion. But now if you carefully compute what this means in terms of the geometrical degrees of freedom, this one, you find that it's actually to leading order, it means it's Ricci flat. I'm not even sure what is the full nonlinear version of it, but the leading order, so the linearized gravity, it means it's Ricci flat. Moreover,
so if you go back to the equation of motion for h is a quadratic equation of motion, like box h is equal to zero.
Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
But then h is linear in f. The equation for f is linear in derivative. So how do you convert
the
linear
same.
Equation into a
quadratic? Yeah, h is linear in f. This is linear. I mean.
Yeah, but the question is how do you convert, so the right-hand side is a solution of a linear differential equation. The left-hand side...
All of these are linear differential equations. H also.
But linear, I mean, first derivatives.
Yeah,
so
no.
So only one derivative. The left-hand side is solutions of quadratic in derivatives.
That's right. It turns out if you do the computation, you find terms like... So if you compute R, A, B... It involves things like derivative of d mu f mu u. This is zero, and then of course this is also zero. So that's what happens. So I mean, one implies the other, but not the other way around. So it's a funny thing, but it happens. And moreover, the curvature tensor of any of these linearized metric fluctuations is non-zero. So these are really non-trivial. Curvature fluctuations. So these are really gravitational waves, and there's two physical degrees of freedom for the gravitational waves. So the on-shell degrees of freedom for gravitational waves, at least in the linearized case, they are the same. You mean the explicit expression of this? It's written. I can show you in the paper. It's in the paper. It's a bit, it's a rather messy thing.
But I mean, R is in normal of gravity. R is a particular expression.
And that's probably because there is a particular gauge. So the gauge fixing here is very strange. It doesn't correspond.
Well, in this case, I mean, as long as it's flat, as long as it's beta plus h, then you expand out R, and there's a
Yeah, yeah, sure, of course. Of course it's this thing. But
that's all it is.
No, sure. It's just, okay. On that level, it's the same thing, of course. But I just want to say that it's actually non-zero. It could be that by some funny cancellations, it's zero. But it's really non-zero. No, if it were pure gauge, then it would be zero. The point is, so my statement is that this is Ricci flat, but they're not pure gauge. That's what I'm saying. No, only those which are not pure gauge. The pure gauge degrees of freedom I don't have, but the ones which I get after factoring out the pure gauge one, those I get. This is the statement.
But you're not missing any gravity.
No, that's the point. No, I don't miss him.
That's a strong statement, because essentially what you're saying is that you can linearize, I mean, you want to solve this quadratic equation in derivative. And then you say, well, it's enough to have this kind of linear equation. And they carry the same number of degrees of freedom. So in some sense, it's a funny property.
They carry the same degrees of freedom only after factoring out the pure gauge stuff.
Right, I mean, degrees of freedom means factoring out the pure gauge
stuff. Yeah, then it's essentially clear. Yeah, but then this. I mean, there is no.
It should be a very simple, clear property of this additional the kinetic term for the gravity. That is, you can make some change of variables such that it becomes just one unit.
Yeah, I think that's basically that's the observation, yes. But again, it only works, of course, in a non-commutative case, because even to write it down, you need the data in the background. Otherwise, you can't even write down the H in terms of F. So this thing only makes sense in a non-commutative space. Otherwise, there is no such thing.
You're really surprising, because one of the terms in the radical here, in order to do that, you have to disentangle one of the derivatives.
Yeah.
So that d mu acts on f mu. The right definition of each operator contains a box operator. This box operator.
Yeah. Of course, box F is also zero. I mean,
you don't expect.
I mean, it works. That's the only thing. I can show you in detail. This is really, I mean, there is. I mean, that's maybe. Can we discuss this later? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really true. Okay. So, so this was the point about the gravitational waves. And so the conclusion is that this is a restricted class of metrics, but it's good enough to describe the on-shell degrees of freedom of at least for the vacuum and at least in the linear case. So it's more or less, but at least these basic things work out. Okay. Now, what about the non-Newtonian limit? So what if you want to add matter? And here this is an incomplete answer, but at least partially it's okay. It's, so far it seems okay. Now, the question is, are there sufficient degrees of freedom in this class of metrics to describe the most general geometries with matter? And this, the answer is yes, at least in a Newtonian limit. This is what I know. In general, I don't know. So the point is that you can indeed, so the Newtonian limit is described by this type of metric. And indeed, the claim is that it's possible to write down the most general metric of this form in terms of the class of metrics that I've given you before. And again, so one can do it explicitly. And it means so this works for the most general matter mass distribution. So also for the Newtonian limit, you have sufficiently degrees of freedom in this funny restricted class of metric. So this is why I would say this seems to be a physically reasonable class of gravity theory. One should call it gravity. No, I just checked that here I can use the most general function u. So I can write down a formula for this, assuming that here is the most general function u. I mean, rho.
Then you can reproduce this kind of metric.
Yeah. In the variables, in terms of the Poisson structure. That's right. That's the statement. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's clear you want, maybe I should comment later, but you have all these. Okay.
Of course, I know that I cannot produce the most general thing which couples to the most general energy momentum, then, but this won't work. But this thing works. Okay. And also, of course, the vacuum equations of motion imply that this is actually correct. So the leading relativistic correctness is okay, but that follows from the statement I said before because it's Ricci flat. Okay. Now, so finally, what about, the obvious question, so what about the Hanson-Hilbert action? Because I didn't write down any Hanson-Hilbert action. And so there are two answers to this question. The first surprising answer is that at the tree level, you actually do get the correct equations of motion from the tree-level action, which is not the Einstein-Hilbert action. This is what I said before. And in fact, I was a little tiny bit sloppy. The correct statement is that it is actually Ricci flat with respect to a rescaling of that metric, and the rescaling such that it's unimodular. I just didn't say it before. I just didn't want to confuse too much. That's the technically correct result. Now, the other more important answer is that, of course, if you quantize the whole thing at one loop, for example, if you integrate out the scalar field or whatever, you get, of course, an induced Einstein-Hilbert action. So generally, you get an effective action of this form. And this term is actually not here, essentially, because this is 1.
Well, you don't know that, because you don't
have that. Symmetry. I know that. No, you don't need it. No.
Because of the symmetry.
No. This works. It doesn't need any symmetry. This is it's a correct statement. I will check it. No, even that. That's correct. I know that, and I will check. I even check it explicitly. That's what I want to say.
So why is it
this.
That's
a way of seeing it quickly, but nevertheless, even if you don't have the symmetry, it's still true. I mean,
right.
This is the same effect because the action that I write down are the same action that everybody writes down. It is the standard action of a scalar field coupled to a metric. It's precisely the same action. So this is just I take over the standard results. This is not a new statement.
You mean that you have an effective difference symmetry?
No, it doesn't matter. I mean, you used quantize a scalar field coupled in a standard way to a gravitational field. One loop effective action is this. You don't need any diffeo for this argument. What doesn't it? That's right. Eta doesn't enter.
It's
yeah.
Action,
so if I write down the action for the scalar field, Eta doesn't enter. It's really I can put it in a form which is completely standard, and then I can use the standard result. it's again, it's when it involves some, but because it's a standard action, it does that.
Well, it means, if you say the standard action, it means that there is differentiation.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. Yeah, on this semi-classical limit, there is differentiation. So on the semi-classical limit, the thing is generally covariant. Certainly for the scalar field, and now if you assume that the scalar densities are really scalar fields, then everything is generally covariant on the semi-classical level, not on the fundamental level. This is also one statement that I wanted to make.
Square root of G trace of G.
That part was for the U1 part, and I make no statement about. I mean, if you consider these as a scalar field, then yeah, so it would be covariant at most for volume preserving transformations and things like that. So anyway, I mean, the thing is not generally covariant. Some of these terms are, some are not, at least, or only if you take into account some scale, some density some properties of the densities. There is much to be said about that. But I want to say one more statement here. And the point is that what I just said about the induced gravity action is very closely related to what's known as UVIR mixing of non-commutative gauge theory. Well, let me just remind you or tell you that it's very well known. If one tries to quantize non-commutative gauge theory, one finds big trouble. Namely, one finds so-called UVIR mixing, which means that you get new divergences which are not there in the original action. And there is no way to observe this new divergences by terms which in the gauge theory. And this is supposed to be a big problem for the non-commutative gauge theories. And it turns out these divergences lead to singularities in the infrared. That's why it's called infrared ultraviolet mixing. And technically, it means it corresponds to non-planar diagrams. When you integrate out non-planar diagrams, they are finite, but they are not finite if the external momentum goes to zero. This is a very well-known thing. And more precisely, the effective action that you get at one loop level involves terms of the following form. It's field strength contracted with the theta square. And then there is this funny factor, lambda effect to the fourth power. And this is an effective cutoff for non-planar diagrams. And it turns out that, so if you get rid of the cutoff, then this gives you a singularity in the infrared. So this is just, okay, some standard things which I have to mention here. And the point is, of course, so this first of all means that these gauge theories, non-commutative gauge theories, are not renormalizable because you can't absorb this term. But another funny thing is that this effect is restricted to the trace U1 sector. That's well known also. And of course now, but what I said before, this is now becomes very clear. Namely, the trace U1 sector, in fact, it should be understood in this geometric way. And if you understand it in the geometric way, it's clear that if you start to quantize it, you'll get new terms, namely you get precisely the new Einstein-Hilbert terms. And these new terms correspond precisely to the UVIR mixing. And that's one of the statements I make here. And so we have now verified this also directly. So the statement is that the effective action for UVIR mixing in the non-commutative gauge theory is precisely, at least in a certain infrared domain, captured by this effective gravity action. And so if you use the change of variables expressing metric in terms of gauge fields, which I gave you before, this is a true statement. So without any assumption, this is just by brute force rejected and it's correct. So UVIR mixing for non-commutative gauge theory is because these are gravity theories. So this gives you a complete picture of UVIR mixing, at least in some suitable regime. So that paper will be out in a week or two. And let me just say that, okay, one can also add fermions. And in principle, this works in a reasonable way. I mean, this is an ongoing collaboration. They also couple, of course, to the effective metric. There are some subtleties, but anyway, seems to be reasonable. So let me briefly summarize. So the main statement is that a standard matrix model of this type describes actually, well, SUN gauge theory coupled to gravity. So this gives you a simple and very intrinsically non-commutative mechanism how to generate gravity, and it's really a relation between non-commutative spaces and gravity. Now, it solves also the problem how to define non-commutative SUN gauge theory, because these are actually SUN gauge theory, it's just that they couple to gravity. And as far as the gravity is concerned, again, it's not the same as general relativity, but it seems close enough to general relativity in certain nice situations. How far this extends, I simply don't know. And particularly what I checked is you get the standard vacuum equations of motion, at least in the linearized case. The Newtonian limit seems to be okay, and I don't want to say much here. And the same conclusion, the same mechanism should, of course, apply to the string theoretical matrix model, in particular the IKKT model. because I mean the same story was not applied, was not restricted to four dimensions. It gives you an explanation, and even really an explanation in detail of non-commutative, of UVIR mixing non-commutative gauge theory. And the whole framework is, of course, it's in principle quite suitable for quantization, because quantizing this thing is now as easy as quantizing gauge theory. Now that you understand the UVIR mixing. So one has to now make sure, I mean, now there is much to be said about it, but I claim this is quite suitable for quantization. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say.
Questions, comments, concerns? So your basic variable is the step that you make this approximation of semi-classical in which a space-time makes sense. Yeah. Your basic variable are these Poisson structures.
That's right, yeah, that's right.
They have only 6 degrees of 4 dimensions, they have only 6.
Yes, they have something like that. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
So, what do you think? Suppose you wanted to produce a highly nonlinear thing like a black hole spiral pattern. Would it take some sort of miracle to be able to trust? So have you checked? But maybe that miracle is
okay.
Some,
no.
Have you checked whether something like a Schwarzschild metric can be?
Okay, so I think the Schwarzschild metric, I think should, I have not, I don't have the Schwarzschild.
Schwarzschild metric is too homogeneous.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe it can be
that. I think. So I think for, that's right. I think for the Schwarzschild metric, it's okay, because Schwarzschild is a vacuum solution. So I think there it should be okay. I have the same number of degrees of freedom for vacuum.
Yeah, but that was linearized.
Yeah, it was linearized. But I mean, the real thing is nonlinear, of course. So there will be changes, which I haven't worked out the Schwarzschild solution in general. It's not so easy, actually. And I don't know the full answer. But here, I think that this should work. I mean, it will probably not be exactly Schwarzschild. It may have some, it will be a bit different. But I would say there should be something like a black hole. I'm convinced. No, but of course,
You have some algebraic condition on
the metric. Yeah, but again, for the vacuum, as long as there is no matter, I have the same number of physical degrees of freedom. Now, it may give me some deformation of the Schwarzschild, but.
Like a Schwarzschild is like a Coulomb, so it's not like.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the things.
I don't know that those
work. No, but I mean, the Coulomb solution is there completely. And Schwarzschild, okay, is a nonlinear version of it. This does have a nonlinear version of Coulomb, which I haven't worked out, but Coulomb is there in full generality. So there will be something like that, and I would be surprised if there wasn't a horizon. Okay, this I don't know, of course.
No, but the question is, would you come close? Still we'll have experimental evidence.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
okay. No, okay, first of all. Okay, so how close it comes, I simply don't know. Okay, obviously this is urgent to work out. It's not so easy. There will be some. And also, the thing that said is, of course, this is quite a restrictive framework. It's only a falsifiable thing, but okay. Nevertheless, there is some space. There is some space to extend this class of metrics. If you would add extra dimensions, for example, then I'm not sure what would happen. There might be some more, but I don't want to. If I don't enter into that, it's very rigid, and you will get some version of Schwarzschild, which maybe how different it is. I don't know. This has to be done, but. There should be black holes, I would say.
Well, you only have to match Schwarzschild in one coordinate.
Sorry?
You only have to match it in some coordinate.
That's right, exactly. That's the point, yeah. That's the point. Yeah. Exactly. No, as from the number of degrees of freedom, there's no problem. The nonlinear stuff may be different. How different it is, I just don't know. I mean, this has to be done. But in principle, I think it's okay.
So what are the kind of Boltzmann interactions?
The kind of what?
Boltzmann interactions.
No. Okay, what I said here is only the leading relativistic corrections. So this is almost trivial. So so far I only know the leading relativistic ones. The other ones have to be worked out. No, this is very new stuff. No, I mean this all has to be done.
You were going to say something about photons.
Yeah, okay. So the point is, people were always trying to find the non-commutative photons, and it didn't work. That was the whole. In fact, that's the reason why most people left the subject, because the photon didn't come out right. And the reason is UVIR mixing. So this tells you, this naive U1, the trace U1 is certainly not a photon. But of course, now, if you can do something like a grand unified model. So I'm saying the physical photon should arise from some kind of a grand unified when it has simultaneously spontaneous symmetry breaking of some, let's say, SU5 or whatever. That's how it should come. And these photons, they do not have UVR mixing, and they should be, I mean, that could work.
So this UVR mixing thing is something that happens when you quantize a theory, taking into account, like, breaking or lowering.
Just quantize it. It comes out, you get UVR mixing. There's no way around it.
No, but if you instead might take the catalyst, okay.
I think even there you find some version of it. Okay. Yeah, actually I would have to look it up. I haven't done that computation. You get some version of
right,
it.
Right, on the same level.
Yeah.
Okay, same,
yeah.
Same level. So you mentioned this Moyal plane, but you never mentioned the symmetries of this Moyal plane.
That's right, because
this Moyal plane as some sort of
Moyal, so the essential property that I need is the non-commutativity is non-degenerate. So the Poisson structure must be non-degenerate. That's the main thing. Now, whether it's Moyal or some curved version of Moyal, that doesn't matter. And as far as symmetries are concerned, my answer is the following, that at the level of these leading terms in effective action, the symmetry is completely restored. You don't see the data anymore. The data is completely absorbed in the metric, so the symmetry issue is gone. Now, if you go to higher order corrections in data, probably they will break it, I would expect. Anyway, I mean, in a curved space, there is no symmetry. Okay.
So. What about other topologies?
Yeah, yeah, okay, thank you. So there is versions of these matrix models which describe spheres or CP2 and things like that. There is a certain zoo of other topologies, but certainly not the most general one. So, yeah, that's what I know. So I think the mechanism would apply also certainly to certain other topologies, but I think the class of topologies will be certainly smaller than you get in ordinary geometries. I'm quite sure about that. But
well, it's about, so you talked about having enough degrees of freedom, but there's another worry on the other side, which would be having too much degrees of freedom. There is usually a mismatch, but most of it is pure gauge, because you have different symmetry. So now you have, you know, kind of a smaller metric, but, and there is maybe, you know, these two graviton components. Mm. And then there are the other components, which usually can be treated as pure gauge, but in your model, because it's broken, they will become dynamical.
No.
Anything that, you know, anything like that, it becomes dynamical. So it means that if you have the two graviton, you have also some extra, you know, degrees of freedom that might be just ghosting.
Yeah. There is one of these. There is one degree of freedom corresponding to diffeos, and these are the simplector morphisms. So, and it's precisely, so everything works out completely. So no. These ghost-like things, they are under control, and they are understood as being some part of the diffeomorphism group.
But what I'm talking about is the part of the metric, which usually is pure gauge. So it's not dynamical.
Yeah.
But in your model, this part of the metric is no longer pure gauge, so it becomes dynamical.
No, it's not there. There is a constraint. The space of metrics, there is only a submanifold, which cuts out most of these pure gauges. The only pure gauge which survives the constraint are the simplector morphisms, and they are actually gauged here in a correct way, and there is no ghost and nothing whatsoever. There is no problem as well. Yeah, that's for sure. And it's obvious because, you know, because of that alternative interpretation as U1 gauge theory, and there it's obvious. There are.
You have 6 degrees of freedom, and you want to get to 2. So you have to have 2 first class.
Yeah, no, it's actually 6 is not correct, it's 4. So it's 4. There is one on-shell condition, one pure gauge, and leaves you 2. Because the potential is A mu. It has 4. Yeah, and so and this constraint business is precisely the same as in a gauge theory. Because it is a U1 gauge theory. You can consider it the same as U1. A mu. The vector potential has 4 degrees of freedom.
Yeah, the
data mu, theta is dA. So there is 4, actually only 4. So theta, but the symplectic form, theta inverse is omega is dA. And this has 4 degrees of freedom, that's it. There is 2 physical, one pure gauge, and one is an on-shell condition. And so there is no ghost here. This is certainly okay.
Thank you. So let's thank the speaker again.
Okay.